hopefully we're feedback free here today at Twisted Root Burger Company on SMU Boulevard in Dallas, Texas. It's the definitive quasi-independent podcast that covers the NBA and your world champion. Say that again and process it. Your world champion, Dallas Mavericks, the Mavericks Outsider Report. I'm Rylan Rowe. I do sports. With me, as always, more importantly, is the mild-mannered reporter, Mr. Brian Gutierrez, although you may know him as Ballin' with Brian. And joining us today for our special championship edition of Mavericks Outsider Report is the TV voice of the Mavericks, Mr. Mark Falwell.
Hello.
Hey. Oh.
It's good to talk to you guys again.
Good to talk to you, brother.
It's been a minute.
It has been a minute. I always tell everyone that besides the fact that you guys are my little brothers, outside of my own ticket post-game show duty, this is my favorite show to do, to talk about the Mavs. And especially now that we have the championship edition.
We can gloat and bask.
Oh, man, we can.
The gloating, basking edition.
There's going to be a lot of gloating and basking today.
Has it been 10 days?
It's been 8.
You know I'm bad with days.
Yeah, you don't even. Brian typically doesn't even know generally what day of the week it is.
It's been 9, man.
So
it's been 9 days.
Oh, it's Tuesday. Yeah. See, I don't either.
There was one on the 12th, and today's the 21st. Yeah. So
it was the 12th?
Yeah, 9 days as a champion.
Wow. Okay, that's awesome. I mean, looking at that little banner right there for the adult beverage that says 2011 NBA Champions Dallas Mavericks.
The Budweiser banner?
It's still kind of, I was thinking about it today. It's starting to finally sink in today.
It sunk in. I think it sunk in really with the parade. The parade and the rally is when it sunk in to me.
Those were things that I did not expect, even though I hoped and wished, did not expect to see in my little town, in my little arena, where I've seen so many games and gone through so many ups and downs. To see, you know, that's supposed to happen in Grant Park in Chicago with Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen, and I'm watching at home on WGN coming home from my summer job in high school.
That's after Bozo, right? Bozo the Clown?
After Bozo, okay. Before Wayne Larrivee comes on, you get the Grant Park thing. So, yeah, man, it really did sink in there, and that's why we're here today to bask. We got a big show, obviously, to get into. We haven't talked since game 4 of the finals, so we get to talk about how we won, why we won, how great it was that we won, and did I mention we won?
Yeah,
did you? I'm not sure you did.
So yeah, let's just jump right into it. The first thing I want to talk to you guys about before we get into X's and O's and start actually talking ball, because you know, since we are a podcast, we like to get deep on topics. It's more just time to bask and gloat and talk about what it was like, what it was like to experience it, what it meant to you guys, what do you think it meant to the fans, to the city, all those things.
The first thing I'm going to say is, I was telling my dad last night, because we had Father's Day yesterday because he was out of town on Sunday. The fourth quarter of Game 6 was the first time I've ever watched anything in 3D, because we had to go downstairs at the event level American Airlines Arena, because I wanted to get down there, because I knew. I've been telling Rylan for about 3 weeks now that this was happening in Game 6. So I knew it was happening. So
you were a man who had faith, and I am impressed by that.
Yeah, I had faith. The problem was my faith didn't have access to the elevator, because the elevator was broken at the American Airlines Arena.
Ooh.
So going up all the way to the press box was terrible, especially after playing basketball the day before that.
Long trek up the stairs.
Yeah, four flights, big flights. But going down was great, because I knew.
Because it was going to happen.
It was going to happen. So I watched the fourth quarter on the event level in 3D, but just seeing it all happen was crazy, because it really is a marathon to win 16 games in the playoffs to get an NBA championship, and to see it actually happen in a manner to where the series as a whole was very dramatic. Mm-hmm. It was going down to the bitter end, but in this game, in the clinching game, you really didn't have that sense. It's just that Dallas had control.
They did have control. And I thought that what was weird, my experience of the fourth quarter, and one reason why I was so anxious to get home from Miami and watch the replays on NBA TV, was because my experience of watching the fourth quarter wasn't really consuming it the way you would want to consume it as a fan, because I think I was so wound up in it that it was hard to watch. It was so nerve-wracking, it was hard to watch. It was, well, let me watch it on TV here in front of me because it's on a few seconds delay, and I'll let the crowd reaction around me dictate how closely I'm going to watch it. And maybe I'll peer around the TV and watch it live, or maybe I'll look up at the scoreboard, the center-hung board hanging over the floor here at American Airlines Arena. Or maybe I just won't watch it all. I'll just look at the crowd and watch their reaction, and then I'll, okay, I'm going to watch the TV now. So it was just the desire to see the result that you wanted was so, you know, just so all-consuming for me that it was like I said, it was hard to watch it. And then when you got down to 2 minutes to go and you realize, okay, unless just a miracle collapse happens here, then they're going to win this thing. Then you get more into watching it. Then the emotions start to come up, and it was pretty emotional, like walking down the stairs. My phone was already ringing. The text messages were coming in. Walking down the stairs to get down to the floor, trying to kind of keep myself together a little bit and not, you know, be too over-exuberant because you're in another team's arena and you never know how somebody's going to react to it.
You don't want to punch fans in the face and say, you got a doucher.
Yeah.
You got a doucher who's down now. He's down. Doucher down.
He's down. So that was the experience for me at that particular Sunday night some 9 nights ago.
I'm glad for you that this happened. Last time we spoke, our last show, I could sense it in your voice. You know, we were trading stories, and then you could feel the angst.
And I had a lot of angst, man.
You would still be on a sports walk right now, I think, if this thing had been lost. There would be news reports and the whole thing. Mark Folliwell, indefinite sports walk. He is yet to be found. And so we're glad personally
wandering
for
aimlessly
you.
Around East Dallas.
Yeah,
with the brown paper bag, just slumming it.
You know, you brought up a minute ago what it means to everybody. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to see it is that there are a lot of people don't know their names, but they work behind the scenes in various aspects of making the thing work for the Mavericks in terms of the basketball operation, you know, coaches that people don't know a whole lot about in terms of player development and scouting and video and people on the business side of things and, you know, just a lot of very, very passionate, dedicated, longtime fans, not fly-by-night fans who jumped on the bandwagon because they got good recently, or especially not bandwagon fans like what they have in Miami because they got the big three because they assembled that group together last summer in free agency, but longtime, dedicated, very passionate, you know, bleed blue Maverick fans, and you knew it would mean so much for all of those people to get that opportunity to revel in this and savor this and celebrate this, and then beyond that small group of people that I mentioned, then to see the entire sports viewing public of Dallas-Fort Worth get to, I think, really sort of have a weight lifted off its shoulders because we've had 12 years of flirting with championships and not winning one. The Stars losing in the Stanley Cup Finals, the Mavs in 2006, the Rangers in the World Series, although to some degree I think that there was a lot of just happy to be there, and I don't know how much we as a sports fandom here necessarily feel the pain of the Rangers losing in the World Series last year. I think the happy to be there part overrides everything. Now, if history repeated itself this year, we'd probably feel a lot more pain about
different
losing.
Story.
Yeah,
right.
It'd be a different story. There wouldn't be quite as much just happy to be there. And don't forget that the Cowboys have won one playoff game in 15 years and at a minimum looked like they were probably going to the Super Bowl, we thought, when they went 13-3 3 years ago and then got bounced by the Giants in the divisional round of the playoffs. So we've had a lot of good teams who haven't paid off at the highest level. And let's face it, you know, I can sit here and talk all along about how important it is to appreciate success because it's hard to achieve something at the very, very highest level in sports, and you should appreciate at least having success rather than being downtrodden. But when you get that close, look, the bottom line is you want to have the party, you want to have the celebration, you want to win the whole darn thing.
You're
and
exactly right.
Finally happened.
It totally changed during the playoff run. You know, we talked to you in the middle of the playoff run, or actually really before the first round even started, before we even
right
came
here.
Out here. And we talked about how, you know, if Dallas can give L.A. a good run, I think everybody will come away feeling pretty satisfied. Well, then you stomp L.A. and all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, now you have to win. That's it.
Yeah.
There was nowhere else to go. Because you knew if you got there, it would probably be Miami. And then there's a whole pathos that goes along with meeting them. And you knew at that point it was like, this is either going to be the greatest high you've had as a sports fan in some period of time or an indescribable low. So
thank
goodness it turned out on the positive end is all I can say.
I'm trying to remember. That was a long time ago. But you were in the locker room for part of it, right? Part of the celebration?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, because I got down to the floor. And you had to have a wristband to get inside the ropes or an armband to get inside the ropes. So I got an armband from the great Tim Frank of the NBA because he was the first person I saw. I didn't see anybody Mavericks PR-wise, it was close enough for me in the chaos of the floor to get their attention. But I did see Tim Frank and yelled at him, and he gave me an armband, and he gave one to Earl K. Sneed, too. So we both got out there on the floor. And then when the trophy presentation was done and everybody got off the stage, you could get back to the Mavs locker room through that tunnel that was right there. That was right there to the side of the bench. Mm-hmm. So I went back that direction and into the locker room from the back way, and the people that were manning the door, because I had an armband on and a Maverick Broadcasting, and my pass didn't say media, it said official, whatever. However I scored official pass, I don't know, but I did.
That's like a whole step above.
It is. And so, yeah, I was in the locker room and saw the whole thing.
So I went in a little bit later because I just had media on my credential. Didn't say
and you
official.
Didn't have an armband either.
Yeah, I didn't have an armband. So I didn't catch the initial part, but once I went in, there was obvious celebration going on. But it's not what you really remember seeing on TV with, like, the Lakers or the Bulls, champagne just popping all over
that
the
happened
place.
Before you got in.
It happened before? Okay.
When everybody got inside, it was immediately converging on a table that was in the center of the locker room that had bottles of champagne right. on ice and 100 Budweisers. And people were grabbing bottles of champagne, shaking them, popping the cork, spraying it all over each other, dousing each other on top of the head. I mean, you've seen some of the footage. I mean, right. it happens to, you know, you've seen Dirk get it. You've seen Carlisle get it. Yeah, that's basically what it was. It was several minutes of hooping and hollering and spraying each other with champagne. And at some point in time, nobody. I got hit by some residual shots of champagne. Not a whole lot, but some spray got that way. And of course, at some point before everything opened up, I was at least able to grab a bottle and take a drink out of
there
one too.
You go.
So championship champagne yeah. in the locker room was. It tasted very, very good. I'm not going to lie to you. And then there was a moment, probably about 2 minutes before they had to open up the locker room to the media, where Sarah Melton. The lovely Sarah Melton, head of Mavericks Basketball Communications, Mavericks PR, came over to Rick Carlisle and said, Pat Riley's waiting to see you outside. So she wanted to get him to go have a whatever with this meeting with Pat Riley, the obviously congratulatory part from Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said to him, and then I've got to get you to the podium. We're going to have to open this up here in a little bit. And then he left, and then he came back, and when he came back, she said, all right, guys, I'm going to have to open it up. And then someone said, hold on. And then I think it was Jason Terry that was sort of the instigator of it. Everybody crowded around. He said, let's get everybody in here together. And everybody gets around that table that was in the center of the locker room and said the Lord's Prayer.
Awesome.
It ended on the amen part was a little bit more loud and boisterous than what you might be accustomed to at your local church,
right.
whenever the Lord's Prayer is said. So then that happened, and then the locker room was open to the media, and then you couldn't stir them with a stick in there at that point, as my dad used to say.
It was chaos. Once things sort of slowed down, one of the things that I'll always remember, because we always talk about Rick Carlisle, and he's no-nonsense, in-the-moment
yep.
Disposition galore. But he was finally relaxing and enjoying the moment, and I went ahead and extended my hand for a handshake to congratulate him. He was like, no. We're going to hug this out.
He said, bring it in.
So he gave me the bring it in, and I was like, wow, he's definitely enjoying this moment. And I was just thinking,
if you get a bro hug from the Rickster,
yeah.
the celebration's on.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, all the rules are changed.
The game has changed.
Anything
Not just
goes.
The rules,
yeah.
the game
the
has changed
game.
Then
yeah.
when that happens.
Well, it's good to know for sure that they had that moment, because I haven't been able to really keep up with it. But
yes, they did.
Once I went in, it was enjoying the moment, but they're having their fun.
There was the obligation in media interviews at that point. But no, there was the very inner sanctum of the team, the players and the coaches around the table. And there were people filming, and I was sort of standing off to the side. And we all got to witness that, yes, the very, very inner circle, the very inner core, inner sanctum, like I said earlier, they got to have their moment where it was just them and no one else. And it was really cool.
And a film crew, which means it will be on your championship DVD. So
yes, indeed.
Worry not, you will get to see it.
Whenever that comes.
So I do want to get into, before we take a break, I do want to get into what it meant that it was Miami. Now, there was a time, and that time probably for me was October through middle of May, where I would have given anything to meet any team other than Miami because of the Miami
Mystique,
and the Yankee mystique in red and black, and the monkey on the back, and all those things. Then it came a point where it was inevitable, and we all kind of saw how Miami was playing Chicago in the Eastern Conference Finals, and we could look at how that series was playing out and pretty much said, look, guys, it's going to be Miami. It's time to just strap it on. And so at that point, the stakes became so high.
Careful now.
So, yeah. So, for me, this entire playoff run, there were you were knocking off demons. You were knocking off things that had haunted you.
Slaying the mental dragons. Yes.
You had road victories, clinching series on the road. You had Danny Crawford. You had Bennett Salvatore.
You had the Lakers.
I mean, any number of things. Coming
the
back.
The first round.
Yeah, the mental resiliency of the first round. And so how do you guys view that as Miami? Is it the perfect – obviously it is, I think, the perfect ending chapter to the book. But relative to the way the entire nation viewed it, it just took it to a whole nother level because the interest level in the finals, all those things wouldn't have been there if it hadn't been Miami.
It's the perfect ending to it. Now, I think, look, anytime you end with a championship, I don't care if they'd beaten the Wizards in the finals or the Pismo Beach Panthers or SMU, whoever it were, as we're right down the street from SMU, by the way, at the Twisted Root on SMU Boulevard.
Holla.
Come get a burger.
Yeah, sure. Anyway, it was the perfect ending to it, although I think any time you win a championship, it is a perfect ending. But there was something sweeter about the fact that it was Miami who they had lost to 5 years ago, and because it was so cool to be, not to say that the Mavericks are ever the guys wearing the black hats, but it was undoubtedly that the Mavericks were the guys wearing the white hats. There was, on the Sunday of the final Game 6, there was a CBSSports.com poll that said, who would you like to see win their first championship, Dirk Nowitzki or LeBron James? And I voted in it to see the results. And the I think we know who the answer to that question is. The results at that time, it was 89-11. 89% to 11% in favor of Dirk.
Man, I'll take it.
I mean, everybody outside of the state of Florida was obviously pulling for Dallas.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And that's what made it so cool is that this was Rick Carlisle spoke about afterwards that this was, you know, a statement about the purity of the game and the importance of the team and relying on the pass and playing team basketball, and all of those things are right. And it just took on this aura of everybody being behind the Mavericks. And so to be the guys that almost universally everyone is rooting for, and rooting for not because they're on a bandwagon per se, they're just rooting for them because they feel like that you're doing things in a good way or the right way, or it's a stance against people that they think are doing it the wrong way, whatever the case may be. It's just that was really, really cool that there was such a groundswell of support for the Mavs like that, because that does not happen this day in this polarizing era of sports where there's a lot of, you know, a lot of love and a lot of hate, and there's not a whole lot of vibe in between, and it's hard to get everybody, most everybody, pushing in one direction on something. To have that decided of an advantage, I think, for people out there rooting for the Mavs, I thought that was a really cool thing.
I think it was a good story for the fans and for Dirk and for Jet, for being the remaining members from 2006 to have that vindication. I think Jet's wording was sweet vindication, what he said on the podium, to get that championship, to have it happen on Miami's floor. He was confused one of the off days where he said he remembered confetti hitting the ground.
They had confetti.
They had confetti?
Yeah, I was upset that we didn't get to have confetti on their floor. They had some confetti on our floor.
Oh, okay. I thought he was confused.
No, of course, now I didn't see it because, like I told you guys, I was running out
You're
of there
gone.
Mad as hell, but I saw it in pictures. So talking about the sentiment and fan sentiment for Dallas versus Miami, we kind of got to get into the fact that Lil Wade, I think they believe that they are now persecuted. I think there was obviously some of that planted throughout the year, but I think based on what happened in the finals and what we saw from them, I think it's pretty well for sure obvious now. I think these guys really feel like they're being unfairly targeted, and maybe they'll get a bunker mentality and turn that into some positive energy, but they brought it on themselves. They absolutely brought it on themselves. And there's nothing sweeter than watching those guys lose.
The free agency championship parade is when that all started.
Yeah, exactly. They brought it on themselves. I think I was telling Clay Armstrong this the day after.
The great director of the Mavericks TV broadcast.
For sure. I think I told him that on Monday, after they won. The only way Bosch, Wade, and LeBron will ever be cheered again is if they play for Team USA in the Olympics. I think that's probably the only chance they'll ever be cheered again because of what happened on that celebration parade when they all signed together. They just left such a dark stain.
Well, and the comments that have been made throughout the year. I mean, let's face it, LeBron hasn't handled himself in the best of ways, from his Nike commercial of what should I do, and that very strange commercial, to the comments to participating in the mock and the fake cough and cough gate and all that business, to the post game six comments about, at the end of the day, you know, all the people that are hating the Miami Heat and myself, they're going to have to go back to their lives,
Did you wake up before with your same problems?
I did wake up the same life that I had.
Yeah, and then I woke
the same
up.
Same personal problems.
And then I went to Love Field and watched the champs land. So
I did wake up with those same personal problems. Yeah. And I had to, at some point, I guess I'm going to have to stop basking in this championship and go back to reality. He's right. I'm going to have to move on one of these days.
Not anytime soon.
I'm not ready yet, but yeah, it is going to have to happen.
And then he tried to clarify it after the fact.
He's smart like that. He'll,
you know, maybe there was truth in what he said, but I think that when I heard it the next morning, or maybe that night at the hotel, to be perfectly honest with you, I don't remember when I read the whole comments of, you know, everybody who was hating on the Miami Heat, and, you know, who's getting joy in the Miami Heat, or myself not meeting their goals. At the end of the day, they're going to have to go back to the same life that they had. They're going to have to wake up tomorrow and have the same life that they had today. Whenever I read that, I mean, I took it exactly as 99% of people took it, which is, this guy thinks that, you know, he's just basically saying, hate away because I'm better than everybody else.
What a doucher.
Yeah, I think he may have been called a doucher a time or two.
I think
in this
he might have,
spot.
Yes, in this very spot right here at Twisted Root.
Indeed. Well, look, why don't we take a quick break, and then we can come back and we can continue talking about Miami, but we can actually talk about what happened on the court.
How they lost.
How Miami got beat.
How they went down hard.
I love it. Right here, Mavericks Outsider Report.
Mavs.com, MavsFrostBreak.com, basketball analysis.
Yep.
Burgers. Who's that?
That is Peter, Bjorn, and John.
Okay, I know them. PB&J.
The name of the song is Second Chance.
That's in a commercial somewhere.
It's in a Bud Light commercial.
Oh, okay.
You can't count on a second chance unless, of course, you're the Dallas Mavericks and managed to get that second chance.
Look at you.
And that was a random selection on the iPod, so I wasn't even planning on coming back to break.
I didn't have my headphones on. Who do you say that is?
Peter, Bjorn, and John.
Oh, I'm not familiar with their fine work.
PB&J.
Really not either, but I've started listening to TuneIn Radio on the iPad, and there's a HD9 frequency for one of the stations around here that does indie music, and I caught this on it, and single download of the one song, and that's how I found it. So,
They got some good stuff.
Yeah. So it is the Mavericks Outsider Report. We're back here at Twisted Root Burger on SMU Boulevard in Dallas, Texas, celebrating, basking, and gloating over the Mavs 2011 NBA Championship.
What are they?
Champs.
Okay.
Champions.
Of the world.
World champion. And I
can't
wait.
If there's any doubt, Dirk made that very apparent in song last Thursday.
Did he ever?
Did you see the...
That was rough.
I think they showed it during the pep rally in the AAC that Clay was shooting video on the plane on the flight back from Miami. And Dirk was on his phone, and he was just... still wearing Yamahimi's glasses.
Yes.
And he's on his phone singing We Are the Champions.
Singing it to himself. Yeah. Yes, very off-key.
It's fun.
Sort of mumble singing it to himself.
Yeah. So
he's just got it, like, you know, playing in...
And he's wearing that I'm that dude shirt.
I'm that dude.
Yeah. So fitting.
That was one thing, before we move on, that I didn't get to get to when we were talking about the whole cough thing, is that Dirk saw fit to respond. And Dirk never responds to anything. You know, Dirk is the guy who, I'm just going to go. I'm going to do work. I'm going to keep to myself. I'm going to just, you know, do my job, yeoman kind of thing. And he actually saw fit to respond to the cough thing. And then he comes up with I'm That Dude t-shirt. It's just, it's Dirk's world. This, at least for now, it is Dirk's world.
Living there.
You know, not that it really matters a whole lot at the end of the day, but those are the kind of things that increase his stature and standing with the casual fan out there. And, you know, I know Dirk doesn't care about endorsement deals and you know, where would he finish in terms of jersey sales or, you know, perception of public popularity or whatever the deal is. But that's the kind of stuff, that's the kind of stuff that gets him endorsement deals and gets him, you know, more jerseys sold because it's taking a stand for yourself. Yep. And most of the time, Dirk, the stand he took for himself was just letting his play on the court speak for itself. But to do that, I was damn proud of him. And it's like our little Dirk is all grown up.
He is. He definitely is.
All for sure.
Come a long way from the bowl cut from Würzburg, for sure.
And the earring.
And to be able to sit and relaxed in front of 20,000 people in the arena and say, yeah, that wasn't a good look for me. I mean, how can you not like the guy?
He's a lovable man.
But you did mention on the court, Mark, and that's where we wanted to go next. When the Miami Heat put away Chicago, Brian said Miami in six. I stuck by my refusal to predict.
Dallas in six. Get it right, dude.
In Miami.
Get it right, dude.
But really, honestly, I would have had no surprise if Miami had won that series just because of the ability and the skill of the big three, and anything can happen. The right guy steps up at the right time from that thin bench that they have. Anything could happen.
I thought Dallas would have to play really, really well, which, of course, you would expect to try to win an NBA championship. And the one reason that I had optimism about them winning was, number one, I felt like they would, of course, get, when they got to that stage, hungry, motivated veterans who had their best shot at getting a ring would, of course, play well. But the wild card to it was, well, only six times leading into it since 1985 at the team that didn't have home court advantage were they able to win in the finals. But I didn't think it was that big of a deal that the Mavs didn't have home court advantage because, and I watched Game 6 against Portland today, as a matter of fact. If they were able to win in that madhouse, then winning in Miami, which is nothing.
Completely apathetic.
Which you can't even remotely compare. And I know that Miami going into it was 9-0 or whatever it was, 9-0, 8-0.
Yeah, 9-0.
Yeah, in the playoffs.
10-0 going back to last playoff run.
Okay, yeah. They had won their first nine home playoff games this year, right?
Yeah.
So just despite the fact that they were unbeaten, felt like that there was a chance because and a good chance, not just, there's always a chance, so you're saying there's a chance, but there really was a legitimate chance because if they could win in that madhouse of Portland, I mean, Oklahoma City was a tough place to win, but if anybody has Game 6 of the Portland series on their DVR at home or whatever, on their TiVo or their
VHS.
DVR, yes, their VHS, whatever, wherever they might have it, go back and watch that and check out what a nut house that place was.
Yep.
And to be able to keep their poise whenever Game 6 was almost about to slip through their fingers like Game 4 was. They blew a 23-point lead in Game 4, and they had seen all but 1 point of a 17-point lead evaporate in Game 4. Gerald Wallace got a steal, got a slam dunk with around 5.5 minutes to go that made it 86-85. And that turned into, at the other end of the floor, with around 5:10 remaining, Terry drives, kicks it to Kidd in the left corner for a three-pointer that puts the Mavs up 89-85, and they maintained a four-point or larger advantage from then on out.
Was that rainbow one that Kidd had, like at the end of the shot?
No, that was earlier in the series.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's all a haze.
That kind of tells the story of the entire playoff run. That timely delivery, you know, of key shots by Kidd or any number of guys, but Miami specifically going into it, you know, the thing that scared me the most was not necessarily LeBron and D-Wade firepower ability to get to the line or get to the hole or whatever, but it was their defense.
Right.
Like, if you look at what they did to Chicago, granted, Chicago doesn't have any weapons other than D-Rose, but, you know, their defense with the athleticism they have, lots of guys with long arms and can defend multiple positions, that was my number one fear. And they really, especially in the first couple of games, you know, they really delivered on the defensive end. But ultimately, over six games, Dallas beat them with ball movement. And I think only
with team play,
only world-class level of ball movement and team play could have overcome their defense in that week or two of basketball games. And Dallas
happened
to have
it. I would agree with that, yeah.
And that's what – I think that's what we had talked about midway through the series was Miami's defense was obviously an awesome defense, but was Dallas actually cracking the defense? And you had said, and I agreed with you, that they were cracking the defense because the ball movement – has been something that Rick Carlisle has hung his hat on with his team all season long, is that they're a great ball movement team. They're an unselfish team. They're always going to look for that next pass. I know, it's bad.
You seen Spaceballs?
No, I haven't.
Well, in Spaceballs, there's Jimmy Walker, you know, JJ, or no, not Jimmy Walker, but the guy from Police Academy that does all the voices, he kind of looks like Jimmy Walker. He said he does an imitation of that. He's like, and then he turns around, and the guy's like, what are you saying? And he turns around and looks at him, and straight up, with no mic, he says, so, that's the first thing I think of when I hear that. Go see Spaceballs. It's worth your $1.99 at the Redbox.
Netflix.
But besides the ball movement, the thing that was really among the many things that defined the Mavs' playoff run was that how they obviously adjusted, how the coaching staff adjusted, because I saw a number that came out in one of the post-mortems of the finals, that the Mavs in games 4, 5, and 6 of series in the playoffs suffered one loss. They went what, 9-1 or 10-1 or some, or 8-1, something like that, in games 4, 5, and 6. The only game 4, 5, or 6 that they lost in the entire playoff run was game 4 against Portland. That was it. They got better. They adjusted, and they got better as series went along.
Yep.
And that was a credit to Carlisle. And just like in the finals, they finally started to figure out the Miami defense as the series got longer.
It seemed like Miami was making Dallas move quicker than they wanted to.
Yeah, the rushing shots.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Rushing shots, yeah.
But eventually, like you said, credit goes to that.
They settled down some.
That coaching staff did an amazing job analyzing film, breaking it down to the players, and just saying, look, you just need to relax, stick to your game plan, and you're going to be able to crack it. And that's what they did.
You know, you keep talking about Miami, Ryland, and for some reason I keep trying to, like, swing it back to Portland.
It's this is the championship edition. We're going to talk about it all.
You know what's so funny about, if anybody also, I said go back and watch Game 6 and see what a madhouse it was in Portland and that they were able to win, and that's why I had confidence about their ability to win on the road against Miami. Go back and watch Game 1, and it is amazing how Game 1 against Portland, a lot of the themes that were the stories of this Maverick playoff run manifested itself right there, because it was great play in the last 5 minutes of a game. It was Dirk taking over in a fourth quarter, and it was different people stepping up to hit shots. But the main aspect of it was that in the last 5 minutes of that particular game, last 5:47 or whatever, they go on a 23-9 run to close the game. Dirk has 18 points in the fourth quarter, 13 of them at the free throw line. He only hit 2 shots in the fourth quarter of that game, but he went to the free throw line 13 times and made them all. And that ended up being two of the biggest stories of the Mavericks playoff run, is that time and time again, with 5 minutes to go to the end of the game, they were the far superior team to whomever they were playing, Portland, Lakers, Thunder, Heat, and that Dirk was an animal in so many fourth quarter situations this year and absolutely carried the team in critical situations game after game after game after game.
I went back and looked today, like, at the fourth quarters with Dirk, but then I went back and looked at the quote-unquote fever game for Dirk in this series against Miami.
Oh, game 4.
Yeah, game 4, where he had his worst game shooting-wise. He went
6 for 19.
6 for 19, 21 points. He was still able to get to the line 10 times, made 9 of them, 11 rebounds. But the thing was, when it was time to handle business, he did it. Out of the 21 points, he had 10 of them in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
Out of 11 rebounds, he had 5 of them in the fourth quarter. It's just amazing how the development we've talked about when we've talked to you about it is how Dirk has progressed as a player. It's just experience and
maturity.
And
knowing what the team needs and when they need it.
And it's needed in the fourth quarter, and he's said that he knows that's the winning time. And it's also funny, too, before the series started, Dwayne Wade was asked about Dirk between 2006 and now. And he cited the fourth quarters. And I thought that was really interesting, because that's where the difference was in 2006, was the fourth quarters. Dirk wasn't able to capitalize in that situation. And I thought it was kind of ironic that Wade brought it up.
Mm-hmm.
And it just manifested itself in the fullest form.
He's hoping LeBron will read it. No. Whole nother story on LeBron. But you know what my favorite...
He was assertive in the fourth quarter, and that's the bottom line.
You know what my favorite Dirk thing relative to that for this playoff run was his orchestrating from the top of the key, being patient, taking his time, reading the defense, and making a play. And the best example of that was Game 3 against Los Angeles. You know, it was here in town. L.A. had pushed out to a 6 or 7 point lead, and time was running low. And we were all expecting a knockdown, drag-out series with L.A., obviously. And, you know, going up 3-0, that's the kill shot. So his ability in that stretch of possessions, there were 3 or 4 possessions in under 2.5 minutes where every time he was set up at the top of the key, he waited to see what was going to open up. And, you know, he's got so many tools in his tool belt for what he can do. He just was able to allow the defense to adjust. A second guy comes, he hits the open man, somebody hits the shot.
Pazier for a three was one of the big shots in that particular comeback.
And that, I mean, we've seen Dirk do that before, but his ability to consistently do it every single time in these playoffs when everybody knew, that's when you go from being a great player to being a legendary player, is when you're going to do it and everybody knows you're going to do it anyway, and you still find a way to get done.
That was what I remember about that game is Dirk going into the paint one time and having to kick it to Pazier for a three, which is one of the big baskets when they were coming back in the last 5 minutes. And then it's a tie game late, and the Mavs had gone ahead, and the Lakers had come back to tie it, and then Dirk drives left and then has the little flip-up with the left hand, almost a little baby hook that he flips up and in, and that broke the tie, and I think that gave Dallas a lead for good. I think they came back down and got a stop after that and never relinquished the lead. They got a two-point lead off that Dirk basket and never gave it up from then on out.
Lefty.
That's beautiful.
That's just filthy.
And the amazing thing about it is that there's so much focus on the finals, but now we've forgotten, gosh, how great games 1 and 3 of that Lakers series were.
Yeah.
You really pulled one out of the fire, both of those. I mean, game one especially, you had a 17-point deficit, but both of those games were pulled out of the fire and really demoralized L.A. You see a different L.A. team, I think, obviously, if you come away from L.A. with a split instead of 2-0.
Or what if Kobe hits that shot, that last shot?
It's a game of inches. Yeah.
Well, that just it goes back to the thing about it is, and I don't think sometimes people understand this, but hopefully after experiencing this playoff run, they have a better grasp of it, is that the margin between winning and losing is so very, very small when you're talking about good teams competing in the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mavs, look, we could sit there and look back at series in the past and a couple of plays that didn't go their way, and it doesn't maybe boil down to one shot specifically, but it's 2 or 3 plays in the final minute to a minute and a half of a game where they can look back and say, you know, if these plays had broken in this particular game, then that would have changed the momentum of the series. And maybe, you know, there would be a whole lot more playoff success, maybe not championships, but at least there would be a whole lot more, or maybe less disappointment anyway, to talk about from some of these past playoff runs. But it obviously didn't turn out that way, and you know what, at the end of the day, once things happen the way they do in the space-time continuum, it sets it up to happen the way they did, and I couldn't imagine anything sweeter than the way it happened. So,
let that check it out. When you talk about things happening in a certain way, there's an aspect of that that we need to cover while we're looking back at this playoff run, which is Rick Carlisle pushing the right buttons. I don't think there was a better coach in this year's playoffs, at least not in the Western Conference, because I didn't watch the East, because you know what? I don't care. They're all, I mean, Philadelphia, what? Are you kidding me?
Doug Collins is a good coach.
he finally got rid of his dyed hair, which is nice. That was kind of freaking me out. But
I don't see how there's even really much of a debate
about
it.
No, there's nothing to even, you can't even bring in another guy and try to even make the argument, I don't think.
No, you can't.
And he really coached Spoelstra's pants off, I feel like, in the finals. You know, Spoelstra, to me, looks like a guy who's just like, oh, geez, this is what I have to work with. Even though he's got the big three, he just has this look on his face that's kind of a detached smile almost. Like, am I really here?
Well, mental stability apparently is his big buzz phrase. You know,
He was starting to steal disposition.
Yeah, he was. He was starting to steal disposition. But then now getting to watch all these finals games on replay and they show the wired segments from the Miami huddle, mental stability. That was his big buzz phrase.
That's not good when you have those three stars on your team.
And you have to talk about mental stability. Yeah, I know. Well, it's just like, you know, whenever we watched Oklahoma City games, we're at the games, and then you go back and you watch the replays, and then you see all the Scott Brooks huddles. It seems like Scott Brooks is having to spend half of his huddle pumping the guys up and convincing them that they can do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, before he can even begin to address actual strategic adjustments and X and O situations, he has to spend a lot of the huddle cajoling them and convincing them that, hey, you know, you guys are a good team. You guys are good players now. This is the Western Conference Finals. You guys were actually good enough to get here, so you guys can compete with the Mavericks. And, you know, Rick had to do, you know, his share of that too. I mean, there's a constant building up, and there's a constant making sure that your team has the right mental state. But it just seemed to me that Rick's whole approach to it was the things that he said in interviews. It's not like what he said in interviews, all of a sudden he was acting differently when he got to the huddles. And that was basically just to preach that you got to, you know, approach it like it's a process. Don't go into it thinking about a result. You've got to be persistent. The game is long. There are a lot of possessions. And you know, you don't lose the game in the first – you don't lose or win the game, for that matter, in the first 5 minutes. That you just – you have to stay persistent and realize that an NBA game is long. And I've never really heard any coach put it that way before. It seems so incredibly trite, but there really was something that I think that he and the team ultimately hung their hat on in that regard.
There's just so much experience on the team that no matter what situation they were going to be in or were about to face, they probably haven't – they've experienced it before.
Well, and I'm taken back to the story that Skin told us, that when he was sitting in the front of the plane coming back from a road trip,
right,
getting ready to go ride with the pilot like a 9-year-old or something. I didn't
like
really understand
in the movie
that.
Airplane.
But he said that JJ told him, as Rick walked by, he said, that guy is the coolest, calmest customer I've ever been around. And it obviously, over the course of a season, trickles down into the team and into the player's disposition, to use his favorite word. And you have to go no further than to say you're watching clinching finals games and you're getting contributions from Jan Mahimi.
And Brian Cardinal.
And Brian Cardinal. Now, of course, Cardinal is a vet. Mahimi is far from it.
He had that sick jumper.
But that one-legged step back.
To beat the buzzer at the end of the third quarter.
What is
six.
Going on? So you have to give credit. When your players top to bottom know what's expected of them, are able to deliver, are able to play within themselves, don't try to do too much, know their role. You have to credit, obviously, the players, but the coach gets a huge amount of the credit there, and we're lucky to have Rick. I was doing my bit earlier in the year about Rick was the greatest coach ever in my shtick, and you know what? It was shtick, but rooted in that shtick was a faith in that guy, and I'm glad that he did what he was able to do.
You know what I've always loved about Rick and why I thought he was a good guy for the job here, and that is that to be a head coach in any league, at any level, really, there is a certain charisma that goes along with the position. There are some people in the coaching business who are brilliant and fantastic, but they need to be assistant coaches. And then there are some guys who have the right charisma for the head coaching position. Now, charisma, I think a lot of people tend to associate that as, you know, that is very enthusiastic, it's very rah-rah. To me, that's not what I'm trying to get at. It's just you have this this hard to define it on the sideline, and we all know it when we see it, and it can manifest itself in any number of ways. You know, Tom Landry was the stoic guy on the sideline, but I think when you watch Tom Landry, you felt like he had it. There are any number of coaches who you feel like they have it because they're on the sideline and they're fiery and they're passionate and they're yelling and they're screaming. You know, Ditka would be an example of one from the football world. You know, basketball-wise, there are a lot of guys, especially at the college level more so, that kind of thing doesn't play as well over the course of 82 games in the NBA. But there's guys that are ranters and ravers on the sideline. I mean, Parcells, to some degree, was like that when he was here. But I just always thought that Rick had it, and the way it showed up was his demeanor was so cool and calm. And I said Landry was stoic. I didn't view Rick necessarily as stoic, maybe because I associate stoic with being a little bit older and a little bit more reserved like Landry was. But there was, to me, he was just unflappable on the sideline.
Yep.
It was, and I may have used this line with you guys before, Rick was the old Ban Roll-On deodorant commercial. The catch line
the never
was,
never let him see you sweat.
Never let him see you sweat.
Yep.
And that's what Rick... That's how Rick was on the sideline. Now, internally, I don't know what kind of volcano might have been going on there.
Yeah.
But outwardly, You never saw the guy sweat.
And he showed emotion on one shot the entire season, and that was Dirk's three in Miami in Game 2, which either tied the game or put them up by two. I can't remember the shot that is now my wallpaper because of all the scared Miami fans in the background. It's great. I'm going to leave it there forever. But
the most emotion that Rick showed before that was picking up any one of his 10 technicals or yelling at Baron Davis in that game between the Mavs and the Clippers back in
January.
That
was great.
You'll have some lunch.
You know, something we don't talk about a lot when it comes to coaches, we talk about it incessantly about players, but is getting a coach that is entering or in or has realized his prime of his skills. I mean, coaches have to develop skills too.
Sure.
And, you know, we saw that with Avery here. And, you know, Rick, if you look at his previous two stops in Detroit and Indiana, you know, he came in with a bang, coach of the year in Detroit, came in with a bang in Indiana. I feel like he won. Didn't he win 61 games in his first season?
Yeah, he did. So, and that was the year that Detroit knocked him out, and then Detroit went on to win the title.
Sure. And both of those, I think, and I obviously don't follow those teams nearly as closely as I could, but
Eastern Conference.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't care.
Yeah, I don't care. If there was a knock, the knock was maybe he was a micromanager or maybe he graded on guys a little bit. And one of the first things he said in the press conference after Game 6 of the Finals was how much he'd learned from Jason Kidd and how much he'd learned from the guys on this team. So obviously you talk about different things coming together to make a run possible. I think you had a coach truly coming into his own. Obviously he was a great coach before, but an ability to be an elite coach when given elite players.
One of the things that we're never really going to know based off of the fact that it's one of those internal things is the fact that he dealt with Karan and Sean early in the season where it was who's going to play in the fourth quarter,
right?
So on and so forth. But I remember Karan in the locker room saying tough times. He said something that was completely cliche, but it was awesome.
Like tough,
it was
like times, tough times make tough people.
Right, yeah. Something like that. But he had those players buy into the team concept. And even in the finals, he had J.J. Barea move up into the starting lineup and Deshaun Stevenson move to the bench. And Deshaun had his best game in the series in Game 4 when he came off the bench. So those instances where we don't see what happens, that's where I feel like he really had the team. He just totally had them.
Well, you know, there's a misconception out there, I think, with a small percentage of sports fans that the NBA is roll the ball out there. I mean, I think that if somebody got a chance to watch a pregame NBA shoot-around and saw what was covered in an hour in a morning when you're getting ready to play an opponent, how much in-depth X and O and scouting and all that sort of stuff goes on. So I think that what's happened with Rick is I thought that the X and O stuff, I mean, I think he came here and it was obvious that he had that based on what he had done in his previous 6 years of coaching. I think that he had a knack for getting a lot out of a little. You know, he knew how to get, you know, look, for example, the roster that he had to deal with after the fight at the Palace of Auburn Hills.
44
wins when they had to use something like 41 different starting lineups because of all the injuries and the suspensions that year. And I think that he had a knack for being able to get a team to exceed expectations over the course of a regular season. But then the things that obviously, you know, I thought that they were there, but there's certainly more of a case to say that he got better at it as his time in Dallas has gone on, is that it's leadership, it's getting people to buy into what you're selling, and you just talked about getting the team to buy in. And it's also, it's management of people and management of ego. I mean, that's a lot of the other aspect. I mean, you know, some of it has to come from the devotion of the guys to themselves and policing themselves and the desire to win. But as a coach, you've also got to, you know, you've got 15 different egos and personalities that you've got to massage and manage. And, you know, again, a lot of that has to be the players policing themselves and making sure that they realize that there's a higher goal here than their own personal numbers and their own personal minutes. But I think Rick played a big role in that, too.
I think he had to massage or control his own ego, too, because he talked about it where this is a veteran team. They've been through a lot. Sometimes he had to tell himself, I got to let these guys play. They've been through this before. And like you've talked about with Jason Kidd, he learned a lot through Kidd, so he had those moments. I can't remember which game it was in the finals, but I remember seeing a replay, and the team was either holding on to a lead or they were fighting back, and the TV was on the huddle going before a break, and Carlisle was just off to the side just watching Jason Kidd go to work. And you're not going to see too many coaches actually do that. In the NBA Finals, game on the line,
yep,
let the point guard go. So he had to control and massage his own ego along the way. And
how about not to interrupt, but how about the whole discussion in between Kidd and Marion coming out of the huddle in game five,
yeah,
and all
crazy
of a sudden deciding, hey, you want to switch? Why not? And Carlisle just, you know, let those guys work it out.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, you look at you know, Avery, just a complete contrast. And this is one of the reasons I started to really like Rick when he came in to begin with, is that there was a time in this town when we had Big Bill, Avery, and Buck Showalter simultaneously. And that's three guys that really loved the sound of their own voice. And, you know, for better or worse, they all have their good qualities or whatever. They wouldn't have jobs.
Sure, of course.
But, you know, there comes a time and a place where maybe that personality isn't the right personality for every team. And, you know, this guy at this time, perfect fit, there's really not much more you can add. It's just that it's the right coach at the right time, the right team, right personnel.
The champions.
The right ring.
Oh, yeah.
The right amount of wins.
Yeah.
16, dog.
Speaking of rings, one of the things I tweeted was, when do I get my ring? Because, you know, I go to Rangers games, or I go up here when the Lakers are in town, and, you know, God forbid the Yankees beat the Rangers or L.A. gets a win over here, and all you hear from people walking around is, we got rings. So I guess I'm getting a ring
in
the mail.
All these other fans
yeah,
have rings.
I guess one day I'm going to go to the mailbox, and my ring's just going to be there.
Or it's going to ask for your size.
Yeah. Is there a website I need to go to and fill out a form?
Or
what's the deal?
UPS will show up with it.
They're just going to ring the doorbell one day, and my ring's going
to
be there.
You have to be there. You can't. They can't just drop it off. You have to actually sign for it.
I
guess I'll just kind of sit at home and wait then.
Championship ring is legitimate.
Well, listen, guys, we're coming up on the end of our first hour. We've done a lot of reflection upon what we did over the last several weeks watching the Mavericks run through these teams and get to the finals and win the title. Why don't we take a quick break and come back and we can talk a little bit about Dirk's legacy. It bears discussion. And then maybe start to look forward a little bit. What do you say?
That's going to be tough looking ahead.
I'm not, like Mark said, I'm definitely not ready to look ahead. But
we're going to try, though.
We'll try to do it a little bit.
If we're going
to
be, in your case, professionals, and in my case, semi-professional, you have to do it.
So that's up after the break. Dirk's legacy and looking ahead.
On the Mavericks Outsider Report from Twisted Root Burger in Dallas.
SMU Boulevard basketball analysis and burgers.
Yes, sir.
Who is this? I know Jurassic 5 was before that.
This is Indigenous.
Oh, okay.
Indigenous is a blues rock band made up of Native Americans from North Dakota, hence the name Indigenous.
I watched Inception last night.
That's kind of the same word.
That's what I went with.
Wow, look at you.
That was the
first man writes. This man writes.
I write words.
That girl thinks you're crazy, by the way.
Right, yeah, that's there. My wife right here, Courtney. And that's her friend Laura.
Okay.
So they know I'm crazy.
Your wife thinks
that
you're a lunatic.
Yeah,
man.
For sure.
I saw the look on her face.
Inception was nuts, by the way.
It was. And the crazy thing is my 81-year-old grandmother watched Inception over this past weekend. And I'm like, Grandma, did you get it? And she was like, I think they made it so that you wouldn't get it. Okay, whatever. So, yeah, we're back.
How sad is it that your 81-year-old grandmother has seen a movie that I haven't seen?
You haven't seen it yet?
Inception? No, man. Looks like it's going to make me... I've got too many NBA Finals games to watch this summer, man.
It was okay.
I've got too many championship games to watch.
That's
I'm
exactly
sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
I've got 16 playoff games I want to watch and rewatch
this
summer.
Just watch every one. You're really not missing out on a whole lot, but... This is the championship edition of the Mavericks Outsider Report and Mavericks-centric podcast. I'm Rylan Rowe, and I'm here with Brian Gutierrez, who works with MavsFastBreak.com. As I said earlier, he writes and TV
Words.
Voice of the Mavericks and ticket utility player post-game host Mark Folliwell, who joins us today.
I talk.
He talks.
Brian writes.
Brian writes.
I talk. But we both use words.
Yeah.
That's the cool thing about
powerful.
It.
It's all verbal.
The powerful.
You know what? Can I say one thing?
Absolutely.
I just said I had 16 playoff games I wanted to watch and rewatch this summer.
You only want
to
watch the wins, though.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to make it 17 because I actually can stomach watching Game 4 in Portland.
Now that you
know. Because of what it meant to the whole thing.
Yeah.
Because of what sort of line in the sand kind of moment that game in retrospect was. So there are 17 games in this playoff run that I'm actually game for watching. Now, somehow Game 3 against Portland, Game 2 against Oklahoma City, and Games 1 and 3 against Miami, those will probably never make... Those will probably never make a DVD player for me or be on the DVR.
Laserdisc?
Yeah, Laserdisc, Blu-ray. Okay. Yeah, they'll never be on one of those things.
Yep. There's no interest there. So we've covered, you know, we've covered the playoff run. We've dissected kind of what went down here in town for fans and the team and what it meant. We do need to get into, I think, probably one of the most talked about topics since the Mavs did clinch in Game 6 in Miami, and that is what this win finally means to Dirk's legacy. You know, you mentioned earlier what Dirk responding to LeBron and D-Wade with the whole cough thing and some of the other things taking place, what that did to him and his perception nationally. And what you're, where you were going with that is that there was nothing he could do differently that was going to change our opinion. For guys like us, we already had as high of an opinion of the guy as we could.
Of course.
But obviously, winning a title, it does matter when you look back historically at NBA players and where they're ranked in terms of how the greater audience and the greater population looks at players and their legacy. So what do you guys think in terms of how this puts Dirk? What tier does this catapult him into now with this ring? And do you think it's fair or not?
I defer to you.
Well, I think that, first of all, I think to go back to something that our main man, Slick Rick, said after the fact.
Do you call him Slick Rick now?
No, but, I mean, for the purposes of this show.
Can we do that for next year?
I'm here with Slick Rick Carlisle.
Just drop one Slick Rick on a TV broadcast and do it on a home game. People will blame it on skin, and nobody will.
Great point. Yeah. I love where your head's at.
Yeah, so let's do this, and I'll really appreciate it. That and another Skipper yell, and we're all good for next year.
I love the fact that after the fact, he said, once you win a ring, once you win a championship, then you're a made man in this business.
Yeah.
I just absolutely love that. And so Dirk and all those guys are made men. But in terms of what it means for Dirk, I mean, it's something that, you know, as he said, you can never take it away from him. And this puts him in a very, very select group of people. What tier? You know, there's probably a tier that you may never be able to reach unless you're a multiple, and not just two, but a several-time title winner that Kobe and LeBron, or not LeBron, Kobe and Michael Jordan, I'm sorry.
No.
Yes. Oh, what a terrible mistake. What a terrible gaffe that was. Because let's make sure. Let me count. How many does LeBron have? Oh, he's got none. That's right.
Not two, not three, not four, not five. You got zero, son.
No, Kobe and Jordan are on a level because of multiple championships.
Yeah.
Bill Russell, even though a different kind of player, but is, you know, on a level because of multiple championships. And like I said, technically is two, but we're talking way more than that.
Four plus.
Yes, four plus, exactly. So there are a handful of guys, and really, like I said, Kobe and Jordan are the two guys that are right there at the top because they were the centerpieces of those teams. And again, Russell's such a different kind of animal than what Kobe and Jordan were, but he was the centerpiece of 11 championships.
That's a lot.
But he's going to have to be in the debate, depending on how the rest of his career goes, for top 10 all time.
Boom. Boom.
This guy already had him in his top 10.
Put him down before he even got it right.
We went deep into the science back in January or February, about the time that Dirk passed Larry Bird on the all-time scoring list, and then Rick obviously made some comments about how he felt about Dirk's legacy. He put him in the top 10, and so Brian did too. I had him in like 12
or 13. Rick has him as the best player in the game today.
Yeah.
Because of his uniqueness, among other things.
Best player on the planet.
Yeah, best player on the planet.
He went all John Nash style with spreadsheets and all kinds of different stuff for his top 10.
Former general manager of the New Jersey Nets and Portland Trailblazers, among others, right?
Yeah.
John Nash, okay.
Yeah.
Or you mean John Nash?
He means the
beautiful mind.
Yeah. Okay, Nash. That John Nash.
That probably,
I'm sorry.
Probably that Nash, too, did it to an extent.
He wasn't a very good GM, so
no,
I doubt he did.
He didn't think about it too much. But he went spreadsheets and everything for his top 10. And I went with gut, just gut feeling, and I put Dirk at 10 without the ring.
So now you've got him at, like, negative six. Like, he just went shot so far, he's off the list.
No. He's comfortable at 10. He's happy at 10.
Well, the thing about it is that he's gonna end his career, assuming that we have, and this will be a discussion maybe before I leave, but assuming that we're going to have close to or a full season next year.
Right.
And then he'll have two more under his belt on his contract after that. So assuming that he's relatively healthy for those years and continues to play at maybe not the level that he played at this year, but at least close to it. I mean, there's no reason that Dirk doesn't walk away from this contract and still can play more after that, by the way, but walk away from this contract being top 10 in the league in the history of the league in scoring.
Yeah, and he should be. And the other question is, I feel like barring any injury,
he's almost at 23,000 right now. And to get to the top 10 in the league, you need to get to right at 27.
Yeah, so 2.5 more seasons should be a lock then for him to do that, even if he goes 21 points per or 22 per, you know?
Yeah, if you played 80 games and you averaged 20 points per game for 80 games a year.
Yeah,
and you did three. Yeah, that's 1,600 points. Three seasons is 4,800. And if he gets to 4,800 points, is going to put him at 27, you know, well over 27 if he scores 4,800 more points.
I'm going to take your word for it. I suck at math.
Yeah. So. Well, he's at 22. I don't know what the number is off the top of my head anymore. It's 22.6, 22.7, yep. Somewhere around in there.
Career points?
Yeah, 22.6, 22.7, somewhere in that ballpark.
The thing about him is
22,
that
792.
Assuming he doesn't get hurt, you know, he will, if he truly wanted to, he could have the option of being a deadly bench guy later in his career when the mobility kind of starts to wane.
With their beer gut?
An otherworldly version of Sam Perkins. You know, if he wants to, I don't know that Dirk is...
I don't think he'll have a beer gut, though.
Yeah,
he
could.
Really don't.
Man, he's going to let it go. He's going to let it go now. But let it go.
The question, obviously, then, is he the type of guy to do that? I think it's hard to say. I think you can't really speculate at this point. But regardless, when it comes to those total career numbers, there are a lot of different possibilities. But regardless, to me, he's a lock for top 15. He's obviously, without question, the best foreign-born player ever. And
well, I think Hakeem Olajuwon would have something to say about that.
He would, but not for me.
No. You're on the Mavericks outsider report. This isn't the Rockets outsider
report. Hakeem was pretty awesome. He does have a few quadruple doubles under his belt.
He owned Shaq.
He did own Shaq. Yeah. That was glorious because I was very anti-Shaq.
He owned David Robinson in the playoffs.
Owned him, too.
Does have two championship rings. So, yeah, Hakeem was awesome.
One of the things that...
That's the best European...
Oh, for
foreign,
sure.
Foreign-born, there's a debate because of Olajuwon, because of the dream shake. But European, it is hands down, no debate, no reason to even bring it up.
Unless you're Vlade Divac's grandmother.
Yes.
And she's
flopping right now, too. one of the interesting things that I remember from the exit interviews was Dirk being asked what's going to happen now with his drive. Now that he's accomplished one of his dreams with the championship. And he talked about how his dreams were being in the Olympics and winning an NBA championship. And he took a very cautious approach initially to the questioning where he just needs to wait and see what happens. It's too much to take in and digest right now. But after some thinking, you could tell a player like him is just wired differently. He's a competitor. Yeah, he's so competitive and so driven where he just needs some time off.
Of course.
To recharge the battery.
To recharge, to celebrate, to savor
drink some
it.
Beer.
Yeah, man.
He needs
not going to get a beer gut.
Get
dude.
That gut
Stop
started.
That. But it is a very, very hard road, as you said earlier, to win an NBA championship. And you don't just do it. The ring's a part of it and the legacy's a part of it, but hey, there is having some fun here that's part of it. I mean, when you've done this, then you deserve to kick back and have some fun.
Drinking that big $80,000
bottle of champagne. Dang. Yes, at Liv, at Fountain Blue.
Dang.
You know, there are three people sitting at this table. Two people were at Liv.
Yes,
at
they
Fountain
were.
Blue.
You high
guys,
five!
Give yourself a pat on the
high
back.
Five.
That's huge.
I got you.
That's huge. It's all good.
I'm patting myself on the back right now.
I was looking at the pictures on Twitter.
He forced me to drink out of...
Listening to Sean Bass go to 3:20 a.m.
He went to 3:20?
Yes, he went to 3:20 a.m. on the Ticket Post game show.
Because we were on with him or I was on with him in the taxi cab with you at probably about 1:30.
Yep.
1:30, 1:45, somewhere around in there.
That's what you got to do, man. Extraordinary circumstances call for extraordinary efforts.
He made me drink out of that champagne because I was hesitant to do that.
Yeah, well, I didn't drink out of the bottle.
No, not out of the bottle.
Just a glass.
But the glass.
I had a glass,
I didn't
want to
have that glass, though, because that's expensive.
Hey, man,
the glass
you made the right call. You made the right call on that.
I did.
You know,
the
the amazing thing about that is, just a quick side note, is how close Brian and I were to probably not even finding the party because it was so crowded there. And I was texting a buddy of mine who was there, the great Brian Damaris, former employee of the Mavericks and still very well connected to the Maverick world. And I was lucky that I was able to continue to exchange texts with him because it was so crowded, so hard to move around, that I really thought that you and me were there and we had bumped into Art Garcia and that there was a chance that we weren't going to make it.
Yeah.
That it was that crowded and it was going to be that hard to find. And it was 3 o'clock in the morning, or it was between 2:30 and 3, something like that. And, you know, what was my patience going to be enough to try to fight through it? You know, I didn't realize what was going to be happening. And so I'm glad that I had the patience to fight through the crowd and figure out where they were. And I don't remember who it was among us who spotted them. But once we spotted where the crowd was, where the table was, it wasn't too hard to get there.
Party was on at that point.
Then the party was on. Then we showed up, and then the party was started.
They were
on.
Waiting on you guys
they
to
were.
Really get started.
They
I'm
were,
sure.
man. That's
you know
exactly
what,
right.
You know what's surprising? I don't know if you'll agree with this, but Brian Cardinal was running the show.
I agree, and it was surprising.
He was running the show. He
Purdue
was,
Boilermakers, man. What can you say?
It's crazy. He was directing traffic with the ring or with the trophy, and then all of a sudden, Brian Cardinal has a trophy and he's pointing it towards me, and I'm like,
and you're like afraid to touch it.
I don't know if I should be touching this.
I was in the same boat. The trophy got pointed my way, and my main concern was, am I sober enough to lift this over my head and not potentially drop it? And I did, and I was.
We're all okay now.
Yes, we are all okay now. Okay. My friend Larry is okay. Didn't suffer any sort of unfortunate dents. Nobody got hit by the corner of the trophy in the face and got a black eye from it, or cut their temple or anything like that.
Nobody left it in a public bathroom.
I will say, though.
It did go to a bathroom, though.
Yeah. I will say, though, that was one of my more nerve-wracking moments, was in that crowd, and having had a few at that point, was getting the trophy handed to you, and it's like, okay, well, you've got to have some sort of celebratory move with it, and just like, okay, pick it up, hold it up in the air, and then it was much like whenever the basketball was passed to me in one of the numerous pickup games that Brian and I played with Ben and Skin and everybody like that during the playoffs is, okay, now let me get rid of it. Now, I've had it for a moment, I've lifted it up over my head, I've screamed with it, but now there's too much attention on somebody who did nothing to actually win this trophy, so let me give it to somebody else.
Yeah, there's no sense in prolonging this potentially uncomfortable moment. That's right.
Get it out of my hands. I really appreciate it. I'll get my pictures with it on the plane tomorrow, and that was my approach.
I'm just happy that we saw pictures of our little Mavericks and our little media friends on TMZ.
You and I didn't make TMZ.
No, you guys didn't. Brian was close because he was kind of down in the scrum. There were a couple that he almost made it into. But,
it was TMZ, so they were still taking pictures that late?
Yeah.
Okay, see, I thought
whoever sold it
to them. We got there after TMZ had left.
They're all worldly. They're all there.
Well,
I didn't realize that somebody had the 2:30 a.m. to 5 a.m. shift for TMZ at Live at Fountain Blue.
That's
that
business
night.
Time, right?
The economy,
there.
The economy's tough. People are hard up for jobs these days. So, I hate to be the bearer of bad news,
next year
pretty much starts
Thursday,
yeah.
And we need to talk about it. There obviously is an NBA draft on Thursday night. The Mavericks have two picks. Two late picks.
26 and 57.
Yep. And there is also a collective bargaining agreement that will expire June 30th. Just a question of whether or not there will be another deal in place before then. And we're going to talk about that, and we need to talk about where the Mavericks might go, knowing that there are many ground rules yet to be laid in this new CBA that we don't know anything about. But first and foremost, I guess, let's hit the draft real quick. I kind of feel like I wouldn't be shocked if this pick gets traded to someone else.
It's possible. I'm not sure. There's different. I've talked to Mark before, and I can never pronounce his name correctly from Moorhead State.
Oh, Kenneth. Kenneth Fareed or Fareed. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name either.
Yeah, but that kid would be my golden goose pick if he somehow dropped.
All the mock drafts, though, have him going late teens, early 20s.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what kind of position they'll actually draft from because there's so many different things that can change based off of what needs to happen with free agency. They could draft a guard. They could draft a big. It's just going to vary. So,
well, I've looked at mock drafts, and are these people making these picks because they have inside information or because they just think that these are people that would fit well? But Justin Harper from Richmond, who is a stretch four,
yeah,
who shot 45% on three-pointers this past season for Richmond, who had a nice little run in the tournament.
And it was like 17-9 or something like that. It's pretty decent rebounding numbers.
Yes, correct. I think it was only 7 boards a game.
Was
but still good. I've seen the name Josh Selby connected in a mock draft to Dallas, and he's the Kansas point guard who was very, very highly recruited out of high school, but has had not did not have a very good collegiate career at Kansas. And let's see, Davis Bertans is the guy's name. He's from Latvia.
Latvia.
He's playing in another. That's not where he's playing, and I don't remember where he's playing in Europe. But he would be a draft and stash sort of project because he's only 18 years old. But 6'10", 220 pounds, something like that. I mean, a small forward sort of game. I mean, you know, at this point, I don't have any, you know, maybe as we get closer to Thursday night, I'll have talked to some people and get a feel for who they like and who might be on their radar. But I don't know that I agree with your idea that this pick, did you say a minute ago you thought this pick could get traded?
I could see Dallas trading the pick, sending it away for cash, whatever.
Nah, I don't think so.
You think they'll go ahead and
no, because
make
I think that if Mark is true to what he said last summer, one of the reasons why he didn't want to do the Al Jefferson trade, among many, I mean, obviously it was a great trade to get Tyson Chandler, but the Al Jefferson trade, he got scared off from that because Minnesota wanted picks. And he felt like that if the collective bargaining agreement is going to change and there's going to be a hard cap, which we'll have to get into that here in a minute, but he did say then that he felt like draft picks would have higher value because you would have cost control,
right,
low-salary players for 2 to 4 years on your team that could potentially help.
Well, you know, my original thought was maybe with the rules potentially being rewritten, they would want to avoid any and all guaranteed commitments moving forward without any idea of what was going to happen until that was resolved. But
I think they'll
the
use
rookie,
the pick.
The rookie scale is one of the things I think that works. Having been a kid that was burned by the Jim Jackson pick as a Mavs fan, the rookie scale was one of the things that was always my favorite thing about this 1999 era CBA that we've kind of been living off of for the past 12 years.
No, I agree with that.
And so,
I'm down with that.
You know, I can see what you're saying in that context. It's a cost controlled situation. You know what you're getting, and if you've got a guy you like, I guess I don't know enough about who they would have that they might like.
You've just been too drunk on championships.
I've been drunk on championships, drunk on rings,
as we all have been.
So the next step is the CBA, and
but they do have. I'm sorry, Brian, no. But they do have 26 and 57. Now 57 they might trade, or 57 they would probably use on somebody that they would draft and stash overseas.
Right. Right.
That would be that kind of thing.
I can see that.
And remember, and keep in mind, by the way, that I hear nothing but positive reports about Nick Calathes.
Yeah, I did too.
And they do continue. They have his rights. They will have him, you know, going forward. He's the 45th pick in the draft or whatever. 45th pick, 44th, whatever it was from a couple years ago. So they still will have him.
And he is a guard who is 6'5", which is
but
a, is
but
a
is
short.
A point guard. But right. Is a point guard. So that is something to be aware of. But the CBA thing today, have you heard a lot of what happened today?
All I've heard is your tweet, which I think is a fairly positive, I don't know what the word is, very positive development.
Well, the talks today included these things, today being Tuesday for those that are going to be listening to the podcast maybe in later days. But today being Tuesday, the positive news is that the $45 million hard cap that the owners were insistent upon at one point in time, now they have rolled out the idea of a $62 million flex cap. And the players are talking about dropping like $500 billion, like reducing salaries by $500 billion. That they would change. Now, supposedly, or 500 million. Did I say 500 billion?
Yeah.
I did. Sorry.
I was just giving you your Dr. Evil moment. It's all good.
$500 billion. $500 million is what players are talking about dropping salaries. If they would agree to a reduction in basketball-related income from 57%, which is what it is now, down to around 54%.
Well, that...
Now, owners want a 50-50 split, but it's a concession on the part of both sides that a hard cap, a draconian, rollback of salaries and rules and taking away guaranteed contracts, going to no guaranteed contracts on a $45 million hard cap, that's not going to happen. But the owners have said, okay, we still have guaranteed contracts, but we don't want it to be any longer than 4 years.
Yeah.
And now instead of a hard cap of $45 million, they're saying that the target would be to have a flex cap of $62 million, and then you could spend over $62 million with your exceptions, but there still would be a hard ceiling somewhere above that. What that would be, I don't know, and nobody seems to know in the reports that are out there about it. But they're going to meet again on Friday, and apparently there's going to be a meeting of the owners next Tuesday here in Dallas, which could include discussion of strategy for maybe one last 99th hour negotiating session before it expires, which would be next Thursday night.
Yes.
Or maybe it's, vote to go ahead and lock the players out, no more negotiation, and the lockout starts at 11:59 Eastern, June 30th.
Start drinking.
That move from a mid-40s hard cap to
a low 60s flex cap
is huge, because the whole idea of that hard cap that low, that would have required a reevaluation of, like, practically every contract out there. You look at where people are now. I mean, that would have just been crazy. So I guess we have to tip our hats a little bit to ownership for doing a decent job of negotiation, because surely they didn't expect to end up there, even if it would have been a dream world for them.
They obviously realize that there are, record ratings.
Yeah.
Or maybe not record ratings, but fantastic ratings, highest they've been in years. And there is obviously a tremendous amount of interest, and a lot of it is because of Miami, and that's fine. But
they lost, it's okay.
But their existence still has generated a tremendous amount of interest. The competitiveness of series and games both throughout the course of the playoffs, I think, added a whole lot of interest level to this thing. The league is just in a very, very good place right now. Now, of course, the debate is, in the NFL, it's their league is, they've got all sorts of money, and they're just trying to find out, they're just fighting over the fact that owners want to keep more of the money that they have been giving to the players. It's not like that they need to have a sea change of how the system is to better the financial viability of some franchises and the ability to compete of some franchises, which is what the NBA labor dispute seems to be all about. But, the interesting thing about that is I did some reading today that said that if you think it's an owner-player debate, and if you think it's that the league needs to change the way it does business so teams can make money, so more teams can make money, it's not quite that simple. What's happened is that a lot of guys, like Mark, for example, have bought into the league in the last 15 years. They have paid higher prices. And, we're talking about, you can't buy an NBA franchise now for less than $400 million. I mean, the Golden State Warriors were a $400 million purchase. When Robert Sarver bought the Suns a few years ago, that was an over $400 million purchase. So we're talking about guys who are making huge financial investments into owning a team. Then we had the economic downturn. Everyone took a shot from that. Everyone took a hard hit from that. And the desire out there now is that this is not just a play pretty for rich guys anymore, that this is, they want this to be more of a money-making vehicle.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of new guard owners that aren't necessarily falling in line with David Stern from the way David has wanted to do business in the past, and these guys want changes because these guys want more profitability out of the franchises. And obviously, some changes have occurred, though, on the stance that those owners have had. And I don't blame them for having that stance, by the way. I mean, look, if you're going to spend a lot of money on a business, and in this particular case, being a business being an NBA franchise, not like you're acquiring, a company, like a lot of times we think of business transactions of one company acquiring another company, but this being one person or one entity acquiring an NBA franchise, if you wanted to make money, I get that. So, and that's the crux of the debate right now, is that you have owners who have paid a lot of money for franchises who want more viability from a profit standpoint.
So we sort of talked about this before the show, in terms of optimism, as we, what was it, 9-10 days away from the CBA ending. The news from today actually left me dramatically optimistic based on...
I'm not dramatically optimistic.
I keep hearing
this rhetoric from Billy Hunter saying that, well, we started the day 100 miles apart and now we're 1 mile closer. And this is like if you were in a pitch black room and you couldn't see anything, somebody opened up a door and let a ray of light in. I mean, he's speaking about it in these terms that seem like it's just such a small bit of movement. As even Stern said that the $500 million reduction in salaries that the players are offering, he called it modest.
Well,
now maybe everybody's just being guarded and hedging their bets.
Sure,
maybe that's what it is. Maybe.
There's a lot of negotiative, whatever the noun and their adjective there is, posturing going on, particularly in the case of Billy Hunter, I'm sure. But if nothing else, I mean, I was in denial. We're going to miss games, and I don't want to miss games. And you guys were kind of giving me a hard time last time we talked about it. But at least what happened today is a measurable sort of change in where people stand, because you can look at that cap number and see how far ownership actually did move. So even though the guys on the other side of the table may speak of it and downplay it, that's a pretty measurable change there that is very significant. Surely they don't want to completely squander the gains that they've made in terms of popularity and those types of things that you guys mentioned, but I'm still assuming that some games will be missed in the long run on this thing, because people are going to get – people, unless something miraculous happens in the next 7 days, people are going to get dug in. And once people dig in, then, you know, who knows what
can happen.
Well,
they're not dug in right now, it sounds like.
Well, I remember when I say dramatically optimistic, I remember the number we talked about – when we talked about it, Mark, was...
Okay, what was that?
It was 15%.
That was what I gave it?
Yeah.
15%?
Yeah, I would say it's considerably higher, at least. It's not in above 50%, but I've got to say it's closer to, I don't know, 35, 40% at this point, where I would say that's dramatic in that instance.
Yeah, I would agree with you that I probably feel like there's a 30 to 35% chance of it working out.
So I would say that momentum is building. They're not separating from each other, no matter what.
That's true, and that's a good thing.
No matter what they're saying and being all herky-jerky, cloak and dagger with their words, they are coming together, and they're not splitting apart. So the ground is being made, and you talked about it where...
And they're meeting again.
They're meeting again. The NFL's had their dance with this before. They've laid the groundwork. Maybe they can build an extension of some sorts, maybe a 7-day extension, to show that they've made...
That's true. That's it. We did discuss this earlier, Ryland. Brian and I did on the phone that, you know, the NFL back in March thought they were making progress, enough so that they had a 1-week extension, and then they ended up still having a lockout that we're still obviously in the midst of. So progress, when you're closing in on the finish line for this thing, doesn't necessarily mean that it's all going to get worked out. But I do agree with you that there is room for more optimism.
Because I'm not going to drink all
just
summer
a sliver.
Long.
You're not?
No.
Yeah.
That's bad.
This is
bad.
I am.
Okay.
All summer long, every day, all day, every day, celebrating a championship.
It's better than being on a summer long sports walk, which
is.
We knew where to,
yes,
which
yeah,
was what
that
you
was the other
you
alternative.
Were going to be on.
I would add that stick with the bag on the end of it. For
yeah,
you,
like
with that
yeah,
round
exactly.
Bag.
Yeah, yeah. Walk
along the railroad tracks.
Yeah, the stick. It's like you roll up all your possessions in a bandana, and then tie it in a knot, and it's on the end of a stick, like in Snoopy Come Home.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's exactly what it would have been like for all summer long. But now, hey, we're partying all day, every day in Championship Land.
We are. That's
population
we're
us.
We're glad to be here. Population us.
Love that. Well, boys, I do think it's about time. You guys are going to be able to handle the last half hour of the Mavericks Outsider Report.
You've set us up well.
Well, I must say that, as I said at the beginning of the show, number one, thanks to the good folks out at the Twisted Root here at SMU. The Twisted Root is awesome. And so to those that will be listening to the download of this podcast, do come out to the Twisted Root and enjoy a good burger and a good beer, or as I am having right now, a good Coca-Cola, because I ran 4 miles earlier and I didn't feel like a beer was appropriate right now.
Very smart.
But,
King of the Katy Trail.
There you
never,
go.
Never stops.
And I do mean what I said earlier, that other than my own little post-game show with Seabass, with Sean Bass and Donovan that we had on the ticket after the playoff games, I did a lot of interviews with radio stations around the country and, you know, a lot of stuff locally, but I really enjoy this more than anything else because we get to just kick back and relax and talk about the little Mavs.
We just talk about
they're not the little Mavs anymore.
No,
nope. We talk about the championship Mavs that
beat up some
douchers.
Yes, that
no
beat up on some
Mavs.
Douchers, and that's the Miami Heat or the Miami Cheat,
as
some people might like to call them.
Yep.
So.
Boom goes the dynamite.
Well, we appreciate your time as always, Mark. Glad you came out and were able to hang out with us today.
It's good times.
We appreciate it.
There'll be another one of these in the summer, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh for sure.
Once a month.
We'll figure it out. Yeah, we'll figure something out. We'll keep you up to date.
We can't thank you enough for
sounds
joining us
good.
On these shows.
Yep. You're awesome. Just give us a sounds good and be on your way.
Sounds good.
Don't go running tonight.
I won't. Okay. I'm done for the day running.
Okay.
All right, fellas.
Thanks, Mark.
Appreciate it, Mark.
All right, so.
So, Brian.
So, Brian.
We're going to get Mark on his way, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to start to look into the future a little bit for your Mavericks. Obviously, there will be roster changes. There are always roster changes in an off season. We can talk about that, and we can take a look around maybe a couple of little things that have happened in the NBA that are pertinent to the Mavs or just
Nuggets.
Basketball fans in general. So, why don't we take a quick break, have a quick tribute to the big man, Clarence Clemens here, and then we'll come back shortly with finish things up here at Twisted Root from Mavericks Outside Report.
Mavs.com, basketball analysis burgers.
Thank you.
Hey, let's unmute the mics. What do you say, brother?
I like it. Oasis. Oasis?
This is BDI, which is the reincarnation of Oasis, minus Noel Gallagher, who was probably the heart and soul of Oasis songwriting. But you take what you can get, man.
Yeah.
All that is a rewrite of John Lennon's Instant Karma.
It happens.
But that's what they do.
Yeah.
So that's what we do at the Mavericks Outsider Report here at Twisted Root Burger, SMU Boulevard here in Dallas. We're talking championship. We just saw Mark follow Will off to go enjoy his championship summer and run 8,000 miles or so on Katy Trail.
He's going to run on the Katy Trail, and then when he's not running, he's going to do mock draft analysis before Thursday.
Yep, he will.
Because there's not much time.
It's
going to
be huge. But we have another 15, 20 minutes or so to chat about the Mavs and chat about what's going on around the league, so we want to take an opportunity to do that now. Really quick, before we move on to Mav-centric stuff, we do have a minor NBA Nuggets that we need to get into.
Uh-oh.
And I guess I got to get my theme music going. I'm not even prepared, man. I'm sorry.
Oh, this is embarrassing.
Through the magic of the iPad.
I'm still going to buy me an iPad sometime. I'm not sure.
Let me tell you guys, if you don't have an iPad, go and get an iPad.
I'm not going to wait in line for an iPad, though. I'm not going to wait in line.
I didn't have to wait. I just ordered it online, and it just came along. So
is Prince? Where's Prince? Oh, this is...
I know. It's taking way too long. Okay, here we go. Here we go, finally.
Okay. So, there it is.
There it is. If you don't have this, you can't take a spin around the NBA and talk about what's going on. The thing is, we already covered the draft.
Right.
What else is there besides draft and CBA Armageddon, which will probably result in a work stoppage, unfortunately?
I'm getting confident about that, though.
I know you are, and that's why it sucks to not have Skin here. He's at the Skin family reunion where there are a lot of there's a lot of unfortunate sideburns and obscure film references.
Love you, Skin.
But, yeah, I think he's the most optimistic, so I was hoping to get his take. But other than that, there's a Mavs nugget out there. Mavs defensive assistant Dwayne Casey, who's been here in the Carlisle era, has latched on. We've been talking about him. Obviously one of the top candidates for various coaching openings throughout the league. He did latch on. I believe the announcement came today.
Finally got a job, yeah. Today.
With the Toronto Raptors, not the best franchise in the best shape at this point, brother. But that being said, it's a job, and the dude deserves it. If you've been to Mavs games over the past few years and you see the guy jumping up and down, waving his hands like a crazy person when the Mavs are on the defensive end. That's Dwayne Casey. He has been a head coach in the past. Kevin Garnett kind of did him wrong in Minnesota, so he definitely deserves another opportunity.
I love Mav stats on Twitter. We've talked about Dave Keeney
before. I love them
before.
Too. Yep.
Dave Keeney.
Yep.
He had the tweet today, under Dwayne Casey, the Mavs defense improved in each season he was with them. 99.8 points in 08-09, 99.3 in 09-10, and then 96 this season. So
you know what I say to that?
Success.
I need points per 100 possessions, or that means nothing to me.
What a nerd.
Don't give me these points per game stats. It doesn't matter.
It's Twitter.
It's points per 100. That's what I want to know.
It's 140
Throw
characters.
Throw the rest of the crap out of
it. It's 140 characters.
Regardless,
man.
The dude's an awesome coach, and Mavs defense has obviously been effective. You don't win championships without a championship-caliber defense. The Mavericks definitely had it, so
kudos to him.
Kudos to Dwayne.
He will be missed.
Second nugget. Second and final nugget. Ricky Rubio, what do you make of the whole Ricky Rubio J.O. session?
He needs to... Whoa, okay. You threw me off with that one. He needs...
That's what it is.
It is. Apparently, he was going to come to Minnesota. Then he was like, nah, I'm going to talk to Barcelona real quick. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and come to Minnesota. He needs to just go ahead and show up so we can get over this mystique and see if the kid can actually play.
I don't doubt that he's probably a very talented guy. I know he could beat me in basketball, clearly, and he's probably even better than that. But I'm always skeptical of players who choose to go back to Europe and they're not playing heavy minutes. And he's not. He's not playing heavy minutes over there in Spain. He's playing light minutes. And so you really can't, if you can't play heavy minutes for a team that's for a league that's a third best league in the world or second best league in the world or whatever, then what's your value going to be in the NBA? The hype to me, it reminds me a lot of Marko Jaric. Do you remember Marko Jaric?
I remember him, and I know he's married to a Victoria's Secret model.
Yeah.
I don't remember his beginning, the genesis of Marko, though.
Clippers, and he was, I don't know if he was drafted and stashed for a long time or if he became a free agent and was coveted or what the deal was, but he was highly, highly touted, delayed coming to the U.S. for a very long time, and really had a career that maybe lasted five seasons, and you could barely qualify it as serviceable. He definitely didn't live up to the hype, and it's just hard to see a guy who's in a secondary league not playing heavy minutes coming into the NBA and doing anything of real meaning, but it's the T-Wolves, man.
It's hard?
It's hard.
Bachelor hard?
The NBA is hard. It's
okay.
Tough.
Okay.
It's tough.
Oh, it's tough. I forgot it's tough.
So, terrible. That's it all. Man, that's it for Nuggets, dude.
It only really matters to Dwayne Casey because the dude deserved the job. When Mark Jackson, who has no NBA coaching experience,
yep.
Not even assistant experience, nothing at all.
Sure, you got to wonder why he was overlooked, but we got to move on. We got to talk about the Mavs. We got to talk about where they're going. Obviously, the offseason has to start at some point. The draft is this Thursday. We have to acknowledge the fact that you can't bask in championship glory forever. You have to start to look ahead. You have to start to consider where you're going to go. And that's the stage that I think I'm now at. Until the championship DVD comes out and I sit down and have a...
That's in July, so you've got
little,
some time.
You know, one-man watch party. For that thing.
As long as it's not another party.
Then, you know, I'm good. I'm ready to look forward. So
we've got a guest, too.
We have somebody putting some headphones in right now.
Yes, because we just... He doesn't know this, but we just fly by the seat of our pants.
I like it.
And that's how we roll.
We don't produce. We produce on the fly.
We don't have interns.
That's what.
We don't have anything.
Oh, well, I'm glad that I'm here. What's up, fellas? How
What's
you doing?
What's up? We got Brendan of the Ben and Skin Show, 103.3 ESPN.
Listen to the Ben and Skin Show. I'm telling you guys.
One legend following another. Mark follower.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Hashtag grow the show.
Stepping into a big chair. So, yeah, Brendan.
We couldn't get skin, so he sent me.
Yeah.
So, how you guys doing?
We're good. How you doing, bud?
I'm good, man. This is awesome. I like the setup you guys got here. Thanks for letting me come out and jump on with you for a few minutes.
We found this place just through random happenstance, and we said this is our place.
And I'm glad you appreciate our cheap bass amp as a PA.
Oh, I love it. Had me a good Buffalo burger, so I'm content.
Excellent.
Good life.
Well, listen, we're talking Mavs, obviously, but we're talking future now. We've kind of spent the last hour and 43 minutes putting 2011 to bed.
I don't ever want to put it to bed.
I don't either. I'm going to live it forever.
I think I've watched Game 6 about 50 times. It's absolutely just unreal.
You know what? I haven't watched Game 6 at all yet.
Why not?
I haven't. I can't.
Dude, they play it on NBA TV every single night.
Yeah, it's been on there a ton.
They show that and Dirk getting drafted. If it's not that, it's
the 98 draft and Game 6 the finals.
Yeah, you get somebody live tweeting either Game 6 or the 98 draft every night on Twitter.
I was telling Mark off the air that today was the first day that it really sunk in that they won.
Let's sit down and actually think about it, and everything sunk
so
in.
So maybe after today, I'll start watching the replays.
I'm telling you, man, it's just to go back and to watch that, just the emotions that you feel as all that sort of stuff's happening. And, you know, for me, I'm 24 years old and, you know, remembering being a Mavericks fan, sitting in Reunion Arena and being the only person, with my family, the only ones in our section, and to finally see a championship. It's just absolutely unbelievable to think that it actually happened. And you're right, it doesn't sink in.
It's surreal.
The more you think about it, the more you're like, man, this actually happened. This is incredible.
But unfortunately, we have to look forward now.
Yeah, I don't want
to
do that.
We do have to look forward. And you guys know, obviously, the straw that stirs the drink, Tyson Chandler is a free agent. Caron Butler is a free agent. Deshaun Stevenson is a free agent. J.J. Barea is a free agent.
The Little Rican.
And then a couple end-of-the-bench guys, Brian Cardinal and Peja Stojakovic. The thing is, what we were just discussing with Mark, uncertainty with the CBA, the ground rules for how you value a guy are, like, totally up in the air right now.
Right.
We have no idea. But that being said, I think it bears some discussion. You have to prioritize these guys in some order, and there are some that you can still speculate, regardless of what the market is. You can speculate whether a guy is going to be undervalued versus overvalued, and then as a team, the Mavericks, how do you respond to that? So, top of the list, Tyson Chandler.
Without a doubt.
Nobody has any question. Yeah, without a doubt, you want to re-sign him.
He made $12 million this year.
Do you anticipate there being competitive offers elsewhere that make you kind of have that Cliff Lee moment of this guy's awesome, but I'm afraid of that number?
That's baseball. I don't really know. You lost me there.
I think you're right, though, because at what point does Tyson Chandler – do you end up spending too much for Tyson Chandler?
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a team that's going to throw money at him, and while he is such a huge piece to what happened for this championship run, you don't want to break the bank and, you know, basically leave yourself financially broke for the future. That being said, he is such a huge part that you've got to be able to throw as much as you possibly can at him, and he's absolutely priority number
one. And there's a concern with – you've already invested so much money in the center position with Haywood,
right,
where he has five years, $46 million still left on his deal. You add whatever you add to Chandler, but I still think if there is a team that's going to offer a whole lot of money,
is it going to be an attractive destination?
I'm not sure it's going to be an attractive destination. So when it comes to that, he'll take a little bit less to stay with a championship team. If it's a team that's in the mix, I can't think of a team off the top of my head.
Do you think that's more important? Because how old is Tyson? He's
28.
This is probably his last big contract.
Should be, yeah.
So do you think that he's willing to take, you know, a few, however much less it will actually be, will he actually be willing to do that?
Yeah, I don't think he is. I don't think he will be. But I do think there's an opportunity for Dallas to be in a better position. It depends on how the whole thing with Bird rights and all this stuff plays out, whether they're able to offer him more than anybody else. And then depending on what the new cap is set at, who's going to have space to go get him? At this point, you can't really say, but I think you're willing. To me, Tyson Chandler is a piece, assuming he stays healthy, that can make that extension of Dirk's career for the next 3 to 4 years a viable, deep playoff run situation. You can put pieces around those two guys. And so I think you're willing to overpay. To me, it just comes to a question of who are you willing to overpay a little for and who aren't you? I definitely think Chandler falls into that overpay category.
This has nothing at all to do with Tyson Chandler because I think he's an amazing player and he's a great guy. I've had a chance to talk to him off and on over the course of the season. He's an amazing guy.
It's very cocky of you.
I know. Big deal.
Name dropping.
Just saying. But my biggest concern is always with the guy that is just about to get paid.
Right,
and you were knocking on wood all season long with Chandler's health. So those two things in the mix always leaves you concerned, but that's just on the broad scope. I have no problems with him specifically, but that's always an underlying fear.
Well, look at the history of the Mavericks and how they've overpaid for centers. you know, guys like Eric Dampier, who had a great season in his contract year in Golden State. So we throw everything we can at him. Look at me saying we like I'm part of the team.
You got
so
the Mavericks. You got the case.
Yeah, the Mavericks throw everything at him. Because they never had a legitimate center. And then Brendan Haywood, you can kind of make the same comparison, although I think he's too much maligned. I think he had a big role until he got hurt. Yeah. So I thought he was very important.
It very much demonstrated how important that depth is, and I don't think he's all that overvalued, even as a backup.
He did get a huge contract. Yeah. And maybe if you break down the numbers, you can say, yeah, he's technically overpaid. I think you're exactly right, Brian. As you look at the history of this team, and they overpay centers that are mediocre. Not at all am I saying that Tyson Chandler's mediocre. I think Tyson Chandler's an incredible player. But with a guy with – he has had his injury history. Is he going to be completely healthy? I tend to think he is, and I think I would spend the money. But I think it just because you're a Mavs fan and you follow this team
– you're snake bit.
Yeah, you're a little bit wary of what you're going to do with at least that center position.
You just have to see who your competition is.
Yeah.
If it's a lower-tier team –
you should be okay.
Yeah.
You can't let that – and then you should be able to just don't blowball him to the point where he's like, oh, geez, guys.
I don't expect
that at all.
Well, you got to think, too, is Dwight Howard's not a free agent, but there's going to be teams going after him during the summer.
Yep.
So they might be saving that. What if Dwight Howard gets traded and someone's like, oh, man, that was our plan. Let's go after Tyson Chandler now.
Sure.
And they're going to throw money at him. So that's another thing you got to think about.
Right. And if that doesn't happen – people are going to be very protective of their salary cap space for that 2012 free agent class where it does exist. So a lot of factors. What about JJ? This is a guy who Rick stuck with for three seasons when everybody else was up and down on the guy. Took me a long time to come around on him. Finally, I think this year he met the expectations that everyone had after a slow start. He is definitely a serviceable backup. Here in Dallas, with Jason Kidd, having a serviceable backup is very important. And obviously his ability to get to the paint is something that's fairly unique on the team. So I think everybody's clear on his value to this team, especially after the playoff run. He, to me, though, represents someone that could get a little bit of an overvalued offer from someone else.
The problem with it is think about how much money he made this year. He made less than $2 million.
Right.
So it's gonna hit that other end of the spectrum, based off of what he did.
Was he a full mid-level guy then? I mean, depending.
I think someone could actually do that. Right. I mean,
if there was no CBA changes, I would almost bank on somebody throwing that at him. Now it's hard to say, but that amount of take that amount of enthusiasm and translate it to that unknown world of the new CBA, and I think that's what you're going to see is that level of enthusiasm for him.
I just see someone envisioning that saw what he did in the finals. He was technically a starter on a championship team in the championship round. We can make him into a starter on our team. The problem is, I love JJ as a player. I know what he can bring to a team. I don't see him as a starter.
No, I completely agree. And I think the thing with JJ is it's always about where your expectations are with him. And you want to make sure that he's not overexposed. You look in the Portland series, he was irrelevant because their guards were so big that his penetration wasn't as important as it was in these other series. Now against the Lakers he was extremely important, and against the Heat he was huge. And so the guys that didn't have those giant guards that could cover him. So I think it's all about tempering your expectations with JJB and making sure that they're in the right place. But I think you're right, Ryan. I think someone's gonna throw lots of money at it, depending on what the CBA is. And if all things being equal, it would be the mid-level exception.
The thing that the Mavericks have going in their favor is that, to me, he shouldn't be a starter. At his size, he's not a legitimate starter. He has too many shortcomings on the defensive end.
Huh.
So the Mavericks have that working in their favor, that as a guy who you know is going to be probably a bench player, he's going to get as many minutes backing up Jason Kidd as he would anybody else. My concern is that some other team with that enthusiasm is going to come through with a less than judicious general manager or coach or whomever that's going to pitch to him the idea of being a starter. This is a dude who's 5'8" and balling in the NBA Finals.
Right.
He's got a motor. His gut burns with wanting to kick people's arse. So if someone gives him the opportunity, we're going to make you our starter and we're going to pay you this amount of money that Dallas can match, he might take it. That to me is the window that might draw him away. Otherwise, I feel like with Kidd playing limited minutes as he gets older, this is the best situation for JJ.
I wish I had time to do research on it, but the team that when you're
you got
talking
about... It's summertime now, man. You got all the time.
What are you doing with your life? I got plenty of time now.
There's a lockout. You got plenty of time.
Yeah. One of the teams that comes to mind when you're giving this spiel to JJ is the Knicks. The Knicks seem like a team that would throw the money at JJ Barrett.
Yeah, but don't you think now they're going to try to care about defense?
No. D'Antoni's still the coach.
Exactly. So. Exactly. That's the risk. That's the big risk. The one guy who says 5'8 point guard who doesn't really check very many guards in the league, I'll take him, is D'Antoni. Yeah.
I think the thing that we forget is throughout the playoffs, at least for me, JJ was one of the guys who anytime that he made a great play, I was like, man, I love JJ. But then it seemed like the next time down the floor, you know, bada bing, bada boom, he was throwing in another terrible pass and, you know, throwing the ball away, you know?
Is that so a prop bet?
That was a prop bet. Okay. I had to get that in. Okay. And so, but yeah.
Hey, it was, Faison.
But it was so back and forth with him. And so I think as long as – I think someone's going to throw money at him. I hope that Dallas can keep him because I think he's a vital part to the team.
Yeah.
And I think as a backup point guard, it's hard to find another backup point guard that is as good as JJ is. But I think someone's going to overpay for him, so I'm worried about the Mavericks being able to keep him.
The thing with the backup thing is the Mavs kind of have hidden options. We've got Kalithis, like we've talked about, in Greece. I've talked to Folliwell about this before. I think Dominique Jones is going to be more of a point guard than a shooting guard because I don't see him building a consistent jumper. He's going to have a viable jump shot, but he's known as a slasher. He's got the good court vision, and he can pass.
Does he fill the role of Deshaun Stevenson maybe next year?
He could. I mean,
obviously Stevenson's not a point guard, but
he's tough. Yeah, he's got the physical mentality to be tough in that sense, but I'm not sure if he can actually guard those bigger guys.
Right.
Quicker guys, I think he's going to be relatively okay, but you still have Bubois too as a hidden option as a point guard, so I think Dallas is not going to be too hamstrung or whatever the word is to feel that they need to get Bray because there are options there.
To me, and this might be going back instead of looking ahead, but well, I guess it is looking ahead, but if you think about what this team did without Bobois being relevant whatsoever in the playoffs, without Caron Butler, with, you know, Dominique Jones, who they had high expectations coming, I think it's fair to say. Mm-hmm. With those three guys in particular, think about how if for some reason they re-sign all these guys, including Tyson, which I don't think they will. I don't think they'll get every single one of the guys. But if they come back, this team has a chance to be exponentially better than they were this year.
Right. The question with me is, with JJ, if they do have to replace him, to me that puts them in a scramble mode because backup point guards are very hit or miss. I mean, remember what? Think about what Dallas has gone through with Howard Eisley, Travis Best, Anthony Johnson. These guys that you think because they have a track record and then they're unable to deliver. So that to me is what makes that a key re-signing, just like Tyson.
Well, and JJ's your best penetrator, right?
Well, obviously. So moving on down the list, you mentioned Caron Butler coming back. What do you do about Caron Butler? How do you ascertain the value, given he hasn't played in 6 months? You have a new collective bargaining agreement, new contract, the whole thing. Plus, you got your three spot with Sean Marion. Sean Marion just played out of his mind. So, what do you do? Do you pitch him a bench role and throw him $5 to $7 million on a short contract and let him make good on it, and then, you know, bump him back up? He's 31, so this is it for him in terms of, you know, signing contracts as well.
I was listening to your roundtable on the show. I'm bad with days.
I think it was yesterday with McMahon and Kaplan.
Yeah. I can't remember who it was, but they said it was a one-year make-good deal, $5 million.
And I was going to bring up the same point. Tim McMahon wrote about it on ESPN Dallas and also came on the Ben and Skin Show and mentioned it, where it's in his best interest, in Caron's best interest, and in the Mavericks' best interest for him to sign a one-year deal to prove that knee is 100% healthy, to prove that he can put up those numbers that he was putting up before he went down, and then he can maybe hit the bank on a bigger contract after that.
Because really, who's going to offer him a whole lot of money?
Yeah, I don't think anybody is. I mean, I think it's going to be a battle of attrition, and everybody's going to kind of feel the market out and see what he gets. And you know what? Somebody needs some small forward help, more so than Dallas may see fit to offer him more money. And if they do, I think, again, it depends on the whole CBA thing, but I think even though he kind of has this reputation with the team and in the room and everything else, and people want to see him back and want to see him do well in a Dallas uniform, I think Dallas could find themselves very easily in a position to let him walk.
Well, I think the problem with that, though, not with what you said, but the flip side of the argument is, I heard Mark Stein talking about it today, that with Caron Butler, it's such a there's not a whole lot of free agents that are really attractive. There's Tyson Chandler, and who else? I mean, David West is a free agent, but he's coming off a huge injury. And, you know, Caron Butler, he might be top three. He's definitely top five, I would think, in this free agent class. So maybe someone's thinking, I've got to throw some money at him because he's got that big – he's got a track record. Yeah, he's hurt, but he's got a track record of putting up those numbers. And so I think that's a little bit scary from a Mavericks perspective, thinking that, hey, maybe he might end up walking.
But the upside with – if you do keep Butler, whatever the price value is that you talked about Marion – but you don't want him to do that over the course of the entire season again.
No, not in terms of minutes played.
Yeah, so having a guy like Butler totally reduce those minutes down to something that's feasible over the regular season.
The thing that potentially changes is he's the guy now that you're pitching the bench role to as opposed to Sean Marion. Because I think it'd be pretty – I'll tell you this, Rick's coach of the year, if after this playoff run he can convince Sean Marion to come
back
off
to the bench
again. Mm-hmm. Really. I mean, you know, and maybe that's the best thing for the team if Butler is healthy and producing, but – that would be a tall order for anybody. How do you not bring Brian Cardinal back to be the 11th guy?
He's awesome.
I mean, he delivers.
It's incredible how much the team loves him. And you're in the locker room more than I am, Brian. And from at least from an outsider's perspective, seeing how they react to him, I feel like he's a major part of the chemistry they have in that locker room.
He does so much work to stay ready. I mean, after practice, day of game, he's out on the court 2 hours before the game with Monty Mathis, getting shots up from all areas of the court. He just put so much work in to staying ready, like what Carlisle said, be ready.
Right.
He was probably the epitome of a be ready guy.
Yeah, and he wasn't playing until Page decided not to show up in the finals.
Oh.
And Cardinal, with the hard fouls he delivered, he questioned if they were fouls in the celebration. But yeah, he hit the occasional three. You're not asking him to be a superstar, obviously, on the offensive end. But he had some hard fouls. He played with energy, and I think he inspired the team a little bit. And you know, and every now and then he'll drop in a three, and that's just, you know, icing on the cake.
And he can be a third string four or a third string three, and doesn't beat you. Fundamental, knocks down open shots. I'm in the custodian fan club 100%. No questions asked.
Well, then what about Page on the other hand?
I think he actually might retire.
Yeah,
that's just a hunch.
Surely he will.
Why not? Why not? You know, he proved that he couldn't guard anybody, and he had a great game in, you know, game four against the Lakers. So that might as well be a swan song. You know, float off into the sunset, have your championship, and go ahead and retire and be done with it.
I completely agree. I think that for him, his mobility is so shot. There's always room for a shooter. Maybe somebody picks him up, but. Is it any team that he really wants to latch onto? Right. I wouldn't be surprised
We should quick hit on Mr. Neck Tattoo Stevenson.
Yeah, I think somebody's going to throw him more money than Dallas is willing to offer.
Mm-hmm. I agree. He's going to be a tough guy to retain.
That's what
though he deserves. He's going to get paid, and he deserves to get paid for what he did with his flexibility and his effort on the court.
Which is why Dominique Jones could be very important next year.
Yep, definitely. Well, listen, we got to wrap it up.
You sure?
It's trivia time here at Twisted Root Burger.
Oh, come on.
So nobody leave. We got trivia coming up next. Not from us.
Bada bing.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Bada bing, bada boom, bada whatever.
Nothing wrong with a little bumping and grinding. You know what I'm saying?
Thanks, Brendan, for jumping on with us.
Another one.
Yeah.
It's two of them. Thanks to everybody.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, guys. I had a good time.
It was fun. Thanks again to Mark Falwell for coming out.
Ben and Skin Show, 9 to noon.
Yes, this man runs the board for Ben and Skin, and he does get a paycheck. Don't let them fool you.
Thank you. Grow the show, baby.
Grow the show. So anyways, Mavericks Outsider Report, we're wrapping up. We will be back.
Sometime soon.
We don't know exactly when.
We might be intoxicated due to a lockout, but we'll be on the air sometime.
We'll see. So thanks, everybody, for coming out. We appreciate it.
Championship,
baby.
They can't stop a nosebleed.
I don't trust him. His name is Ryland.